This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
In his famous 1925 book, Mein Kampf, Adolf Hitler coined the term the big lie. This lie, he said, should be so colossal that no one could believe anyone, quote, could have the impudence to distort the truth so infamously, end quote. This is Alex Smith. I am sorry to report the government of Japan, the Prime Minister of Japan, has resorted to the big lie, trying to cover up the ongoing nuclear disaster at the Fukushima No. 1 nuclear power plant. On December 16th, Prime Minister Noda announced all reactors at Fukushima had reached the safe and stable state of cold shutdown. The accident is over, he said, and carry no further significant danger to the public of Japan or the world. We'll talk to nuclear industry expert Arne Gunderson about this lie and the truth of Fukushima. I'll also interview Jeanette Sherman, co-author of a peer-reviewed paper, which suggests 14,000 Americans died due to the wave of radiation that swept over North America in March and April of 2011. That is an idea so shocking, we want to deny it immediately. Radio EcoShock will investigate. You'll also hear short clips from Japanese activist Kazuhiko Kobayashi, translated from his tour in Germany in October. Kobayashi reveals the secret power structure of Japan. Don't miss that. So much to hear, to absorb, to know deeply. Here is The Big Lie, as carried on NHK English Language TV from Japan.
The Japanese government says it's taken a step forward on the long road toward decommissioning Fukushima Daiichi. Prime Minister Yoshihiko Noda held a news conference on Friday to announce that the nuclear plant's damaged reactors are in a state of cold shutdown. That means temperatures are below 100 degrees Celsius.
原発それ自体につきましては専門家による
For the nuclear power plants, the experts verified the nuclear power plants thoroughly to conclude that the cooling water circulates in a stable manner and the temperatures at the bottom of the reactor and inside the containment vessel stay below 100 degrees Celsius. Even in the event of an accident, radiation level at the periphery of the plant can be maintained low. And this was technically confirmed by experts. With this, we had a meeting today at Nuclear Disaster Response Headquarters chaired by myself. And this meeting confirmed that the reactors achieved a state of cold shutdown. The accident is now under control.
Our guest was a nuclear industry executive for 30 years. He's an expert witness and a principal of Fairwinds Associates in Vermont. Arne Gunderson, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Hi, thanks for having me.
It's good to talk with you. You know, Arne, Japan's Prime Minister Yoshihiko Noda has announced the nuclear reactors at Fukushima Daiichi are in cold shutdown. Before we talk about Fukushima, why don't we start with an explanation of what cold shutdown means?
I don't know that there's a term you learn in engineering school that defines it. But to me, it means when a nuclear reactor routinely shuts down and the control rods fall into the nuclear core or shot in from the bottom in the case of a boiling water reactor, the chain reaction is stopped and the fuel configuration is normal. At that point, the water cools down to less than 200 degrees, and you can open the reactor up and work on removing nuclear fuel. So part of the explanation is the water has to be at less than 200 degrees. The other part is that it's in a closed system inside a nuclear reactor. And the third part is it usually applies to nuclear fuel being in the reactor. I've also heard it applied to when the nuclear fuel is moved into the fuel pool and there is no fuel in the nuclear reactor. Any condition when the nuclear reactor is open and the system has integrity and the water temperature is less than 200 degrees or 100 degrees centigrade is considered cold shutdown.
So are the reactors at Fukushima in cold shutdown?
Well, it meets part of the definition. The 200 degree number, the water that's oozing out of the buildings at Fukushima is at 200 degrees. But cold shutdown assumes you know where the nuclear core is and assumes you can see the nuclear core, which is not the case at Fukushima. The nuclear core in a reactor, if the water surrounding each of the bundles, which are about the thickness of a pinky, is at about 200 degrees, well, the nuclear fuel is going to be at approximately 200 degrees as well. At Fukushima, the puddle of nuclear material on the bottom of the reactor and now on the bottom of the floor of the containment is not, the center of that puddle is nowhere near 200 degrees. It's likely at 3 or 4, even as much as 700 degrees. So there's a hot molten mass, may not be molten, I shouldn't say that, a hot mass, and above it there's water, and there's enough water to stay below the boiling point of water. But that does not, to me, mean it's cold shutdown.
And an article published at the tech media site CNET seems to add another wrinkle. It says cold shutdown means, and I quote them, that radiation exposure is limited to 1 millisievert per year at the site's boundary. I hadn't heard that before, but given the radioactive rubble and the broken buildings and the 3 meltdowns, is that low level of radiation possible around the Fukushima site?
No, it's not. I had not heard that definition either, but we have to remember that these buildings are still giving off billions of becquerels of radiation every day. The steam, especially from units now 2 and 3, is still oozing out of the building and contaminating the site and off-site areas to the tune of billions of disintegrations per second every day. So if that's a criteria, that's another one they failed on. Cold shutdown assumes there's a system in which the fuel is stored. And in engineering terms, a system has no holes in the side of it. And, of course, the reactors at Fukushima have gaping holes in the bottom of them. So at best, it's a misnomer. But I actually think it's more like, as I say in our latest video, it's more like George Bush declaring mission accomplished. And in fact, it was a PR ploy to make people look the other way. In fact, this problem is going to continue for months and years to come.
Well, in a press conference December 16th, the Minister of the Environment, Goshi Hosono, said, quote, "No one knows where the fuel is, but I'm confident it is cooled." They don't have any temperature gauges down there, wherever the fuel is, down in the concrete, do they? Do they have any idea what the real temperature is of this fuel, as you say?
I'm sure right at the top of the fuel. If you imagine this thing as a blob, and there's 70 tons in this blob, so 70 tons of molten fuel, the surface that's in direct contact with the water is at 200 degrees. But there's about a megawatt of heat coming out of that. That's 1 million watts, or the equivalent of 10,000 100-watt light bulbs. So if you put 10,000 100-watt light bulbs in the center of a molten mass, it's going to be much hotter than 200 degrees. As that heat moves outward and comes in contact with more and more material and cooler areas, eventually it's going to hit 200 degrees at the point of contact with the water. But the center of that blob is clearly, as I said before, and I'm using Fahrenheit, it's 600-700 degrees Fahrenheit. Has to be.
According to the Asahi Shinbun newspaper, also published December 16th, the Japanese government announced, quote, "The accident is over." Is it?
No, it's not over. I heard that too, and it was so saddening to believe that they believe that, or that they're trying to confuse the Japanese public into believing that the accident is over. It will be over 40 years from now when the nuclear fuel is removed. But until then, there's two sources of radiation that's being released. One is upward as gas. And we're seeing that, the steam that comes out of these reactors, especially at night, the nights are cold and the air is moist. You'll still see steam coming out of the Unit 1, 2, 3, and 4, especially 2, 3, and 4 now. That steam is not just steam, but it's also carrying over isotopes like cesium. Now, I think that problem will go away in the next 5-6 months because they're going to build enclosure buildings around these buildings and filter the steam and then pump it up a stack. So most of the airborne problem will go away in, let's say 6 months. But the bigger problem is now you've got hundreds of tons of radioactive water, not just in the containment, but the containment is leaking sideways into other buildings. And those other buildings are now contaminated. As a matter of fact, TEPCO just announced they found another 230 tons of radioactive water where they hadn't expected to find it. So that the net effect is that the core is going to ooze not just cesium and strontium, but also plutonium and uranium is going to be in that water. But it's leaking into the concrete and into the ground and into the ocean. And then TEPCO, of course, is taking on the order of 4 cubic meters a day per reactor, so about 12 cubic meters a day of water, and running that through filters and pumping that water back into the nuclear reactor to cool it, to maintain the water at 200 degrees. Those filters now, think of a giant Brita filter, if you will, those filters are going to be incredibly contaminated, to the point where people can't go near them. And no one's really addressed what the heck are we going to do with these filters? Where are we going to store them? Because they're not just going to contain cesium, but they're going to contain plutonium as well. So it's not a 300-year problem, but it's a 10,000-year problem. What do we do with all these filters?
Is there still a possibility of a further explosion at the site?
Yes. The top of the nuclear reactors has a hydrogen bubble. And TEPCO is injecting into the nuclear reactors nitrogen. And as long as the nitrogen injection system works, there won't be an explosion. If you recall, that you could go inside the Hindenburg when it existed and light a match, and the match would go out because there wasn't any oxygen. So what TEPCO is hoping for is that they'll continually put enough nitrogen into the reactor so there's no oxygen. As long as it's hydrogen and nitrogen, there won't be an explosion. If the nitrogen injection system is not working right, now you've got hydrogen and oxygen there, and it's possible to have the slightest spark in a hydrogen-oxygen reaction will cause an explosion. So if TEPCO does everything right and continues to inject nitrogen, we'll be okay. But the minute that nitrogen system breaks or it doesn't work properly, it allows oxygen to be released, and that can be dangerous.
What if the nuclear fuel escapes the containment and reaches the water table? Could we have a China syndrome?
You know, I looked at that on a video we produced about a week ago, and I don't think a China syndrome is likely because the heat from this 70-ton blob of uranium is only about a megawatt, and that's over the entire 70 tons. So that had it fallen into, for instance, a crater at the bottom of the reactor, had there been a place for it to pool instead of a flat surface, it could have worked its way down. But I think it's spread out enough so that this 1 megawatt of power is distributed over the floor enough that it probably doesn't have enough heat to continue to work down into the ground table. It's still possible. I'm not suggesting it's not impossible, but I don't think it's likely. You know, but I submit that it's, who cares? The fact of the matter is the radioactive water is also carrying plutonium and uranium and all these other isotopes, and they are leaking into the groundwater and into the ocean anyway. So while we don't have a China syndrome, we're putting that same contamination into the groundwater and into the ocean by another vehicle.
I know you have a new video about this cold shutdown posted at your site at fairwinds.com. What are some of the angles you cover?
A couple things. We looked ahead. The end of the year, and a lot of people are retrospective, but we tried to look ahead and came up with three areas of concern. The first is seismic issues on site. If there's a serious aftershock, 7.5 or worse, all of this jury-rigged piping is likely to fail. And TEPCO's admitted that they have 40 hours to get the piping working again essentially 2 days to get the piping working again, or else a meltdown will occur. In other words, these things will have steamed off all of the water, and the China syndrome will occur. So a major earthquake can, one, topple Unit 4 or cause the piping in Units 1, 2, and 3 to fail, which can produce a meltdown even now. So we're not out of the woods. You know, that's another issue with this issue of cold shutdown. You know, there's an implied stability here, and this is not really a stable situation. So that was number one. The other two were exposure off-site, and they're gross underestimations of exposure to the people in Fukushima Prefecture and even as far as Tokyo. We're finding the air filters on cars in Fukushima Prefecture are so radioactive that if they were in the United States or Canada or Europe, those air filters would have to be disposed of in a solid radioactive waste landfill. Now, those air filters are just as contaminated as people's lungs, so that we've got essentially the body burden inside a person is enormous and likely to cause cancer. So we have a concern about the long-term health effects from this exposure, and I think it's being minimized by TEPCO, the Japanese government, and the International Atomic Energy Agency. And the last question on the video, this forward-looking video, things to expect in 2012, is what are we going to do with all this incinerator waste? The Japanese are burning all of this contaminated material in local industrial incinerators, and they're really not made for this job. There's an example. On the 14th, a newspaper in Japan published a story about a tarp that had been left on a lawn in Tokyo back in March and April, and then it was rolled up next to a school. And they looked at the tarp and discovered that it had 100,000 disintegrations per second per kilogram of the tarp. Well, the Japanese solution to that was to burn it, but it was so radioactive they couldn't. So they're bringing in tons of clean material and then cutting the tarp up and adding it to the clean material so that on average the amount of radioactivity that they burn per pound or per kilo will be acceptable. But the net effect is it's still the same amount of radiation, and it's going up out the stack, and it's going into the ash at the bottom of the incinerator. And what do they do with that incinerator waste? They put it in Tokyo Bay. So landfills now in Tokyo Bay are becoming contaminated with cesium and strontium and other isotopes because of this incineration process. And I submit that's a violation of something called the London Convention. Back in the 70s, Greenpeace was very effective in getting a convention approved, which Japan is a signatory to, which bans dumping in the ocean. And this is just a clever way around dumping in the ocean.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Our guest is nuclear industry expert Arne Gundersen. Arne, the American Deputy Secretary of State Thomas Nides was in Japan for the happy occasion announcing cold shutdown. He congratulated the Japanese government, and he appears to be heading a delegation seeking business contracts for more decontamination work. Why is the American government so quick to back up these Japanese claims?
I think if you remember the old movie, All the President's Men, where the Woodward and Bernstein are chasing after President Nixon, and Deep Throat says, follow the money. I think that's what it's all about. There's both the Japanese government, the American government, and the International Atomic Energy Agency are all marching lockstep trying to minimize the significance of Fukushima. And, instead of being worried about the population's exposure to radiation, they're worried about minimizing the financial exposure to Japan and Tokyo Electric. And I don't think that's a fair trade-off. I think there's too many business interests that want to promote nuclear that are controlling the argument now. And I think the Japanese people have been pushed out of the argument. The reason, I think, is because TEPCO has an undue influence on the Japanese government. It seems to me that there's been a cozy relationship there dating back for decades. And it's impossible for the Japanese government to think of life without TEPCO. This problem could be mitigated if they sold TEPCO. And I've been advocating, call it bankrupt, sell it, and use that money to properly fund a cleanup. And the Japanese government is refusing to let TEPCO go bankrupt.
I know there are more Mark I reactors in the United States, the very same design as at Fukushima 1. How is the struggle going to make them safe or to shut them down?
Well, the NRC just accepted in part a petition on Mark I reactors. The release just came out in the week right before the 16th of December, and it's gradually working its way through the press right now. About half of the petition's technical issues were accepted by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission for review, including how much waste is in the storage pool and a lot of technical arguments. So the 8,000 petitioners in the United States should be reasonably happy that the NRC is considering evaluating a half a dozen technical issues. But the opening paragraph of this NRC 2.206 petition basically says that we're not going to shut them down while we're doing this technical evaluation. So the battle of getting the NRC to address these technical issues has in part been won. The citizens have identified numerous technical concerns, and the NRC has agreed to look at them. But the broader issue of, well, should we shut them down in the meantime, the NRC is refusing.
Meanwhile, there is a public fight going on within the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission. What is going on there briefly, and what does that mean for reactor safety in the United States?
Well, there's five commissioners that are appointed by Congress. Four of them wrote to the White House saying they didn't like the way the chairman was running the commission. And there's been a lot of 4-1 votes recently. The four are very much pro-industry, and the chairman, I don't think, is an anti-nuke by any means, but he's more safety-conscious than the other four. The ringleader in this is Commissioner Magwood, and before he was appointed, 100 environmental organizations petitioned Congress to prevent him from being appointed. In fact, one of his clients, before he was a commissioner, was Tokyo Electric. So I don't really think the chairman is some sort of rabid anti-nuke bent on shutting down the nuclear industry, as these four would propose. But his focus on safety has been frustrating to the four who really are much more of a pro-industry bent, of course, led by this ringleader, Commissioner Magwood.
Arnie, have I missed something important? Is there something you would like to add as we wrap up?
Well, I guess this situation is going to continue unless the citizens of the world take control. To rely on the International Atomic Agency, Energy Agency, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, in the condition they're presently in, is foolish. So I'm hoping, sort of next year, I've sort of dedicated myself to continuing to sound the alarm and continuing to encourage citizens to petition Congress more and more and more to be more objective when it comes to nuclear safety.
You have been listening to Arnie Gunderson, the nuclear industry executive who has become an expert witness and public voice on public power safety. Find his videos at fairwinds.com, and that fair has an E in it, so it's fairewinds.com. Be sure and support their important work. Arnie, thank you again for adding a voice of sanity.
Well, thank you very much for having me. I really appreciate it.
I'm Alex Smith, reporting for Radio EcoShock. As you have heard, to face the idea of cold shutdown into the triple meltdown at Fukushima Daiichi required a series of sub-lies. According to a report to the Japanese announced by Tim Horniak at CNET, TEPCO said cold shutdown meant, quote, the reactors can be kept safely cool and that radiation exposure is limited to 1 millisievert per year at the site's boundary, end quote. 1 millisievert per year at the Fukushima site boundary? The radiation leaking out into the sky and the sea is many, many times that right now and every day. You have just heard Arnie Gunderson describing the ongoing radiation leaks into the air around Fukushima and blown by the wind over Japan and over the Pacific. During a state of cold shutdown, there should be no radioactive leaks into the sea either. Japan needs another big lie to make that possible. As our favorite Fukushima blogger at ex-skfblogspot.com writes, Tokyo Shinbun reports that NISA has decided to basically nullify the leaks of contaminated water from Fukushima 1 nuclear power plant in the past and declare that there will be no leak in the future either, even if there is actually a leak or deliberate discharge. Why? Because NISA says so. From the Tokyo Shinbun newspaper on December 16, 2011, NISA considers the amount of contaminated water into the ocean to be zero. There have been several leaks of water contaminated with radioactive materials from Fukushima 1 nuclear power plant. Tokyo Shinbun has found out through our own investigation that the Nuclear and Industrial Safety Agency, under the Ministry of Economy, Trade and Industry, has treated the amount of leaks as zero from a legal or regulatory point of view because it was, quote, a state of emergency, end quote. The agency has said it will treat the future leaks and deliberate discharges into the ocean the same way. The national government is scheduled to declare a cold shutdown state on December 16th, but we are suspicious of the government's position that seems to ignore the suppression of the radioactive materials released from the plant, which is one of the important considerations of the cold shutdown state. Just the leak found April 2, 2011 from reactor number 2 at Fukushima released, according to Tokyo Shinbun, again, 4,700 terabecquerels, according to TEPCO's low estimate, already more than 20,000 times as much as the maximum amount allowed. Both domestic and foreign research institutions have disputed TEPCO's estimate as too low. On December 4th, the water that contained 26 billion becquerels of radioactive strontium was found leaking into the ocean from the apparatus that evaporates and condenses the treated water. Furthermore, the storage tanks that are set up inside the compound are expected to become full in the first half of the next year. The water in these storage tanks also contains radioactive strontium. TEPCO is contemplating the discharge of the water into the ocean after further decontaminating it, but facing the protest from the fisheries associations, the company has said it will postpone the discharge for now. And that ends our quote from Tokyo Shinbun newspaper, as translated by the blogger EX-SKF. According to the Japanese newspaper Asahi Shinbun, quote, 462 trillion becquerels of radioactive strontium have leaked into the Pacific Ocean since March, end quote. So Fukushima is still leaking tons of highly radioactive water into the Pacific, even in December 2011, and plans more intentional dumping into the ocean, but declares their emissions to be zero due to technicality of declaring it a state of emergency. It is hard to imagine a bigger lie. The government has no gauges to measure the escaped and melted nuclear fuel dripping somewhere below the reactor. They don't know where it is and cannot approach it with anything to find out. Lies piled upon lies. Why? The government announced a timetable shortly after the accident. Within 9 months, they would reach a state of cold shutdown. It is 9 months, so it must be so. Even the timid Japanese press isn't buying this latest announcement. For example, the Asahi Shinbun newspaper ran a series of articles with titles like Few Believe Assertion That Fukushima Crisis Is Over. That was on December 17th. The article reveals some of the real reasons for saying Fukushima is over, and they are the economy. Quote, a total of 44 nations and regions have restricted the imports of Japanese agricultural products, and in the extreme case of Kuwait, all food products from every prefecture in Japan has been banned for import. The negative publicity has also led to a sharp drop in the number of foreign tourists to Japan. In November, there were about 552,000 visitors, a decrease of 13.1% compared with November 2010, end quote, from Asahi Shinbun. Local mayors in cities and towns still evacuated expressed severe doubts about the government's announcement of cold shutdown. Even Fukushima Governor Yuhei Sato said the accident has not been brought under control. But the nuclear power structure in Japan has important allies. U.S. Deputy Secretary of State Thomas Nides was in Japan for the announcement. Nides said the U.S. is happy to hear about the cold shutdown and congratulated Japan. Nides is part of an American business delegation seeking new contracts for decontamination. Of course, America doesn't like to officially discuss the weaknesses of the U.S. design for the Mark I General Electric reactors, which blew up at Fukushima. or the military personnel, the American military personnel exposed and still exposed to radiation from this ongoing disaster. Likewise, Yukiya Amano of the International Atomic Energy Agency congratulated Japan on reaching coal shutdown. The IAEA's general director, Amano, was previously a Japanese bureaucrat in the Ministry of Foreign Affairs. And that brings us to this snapshot of Japanese power from a business consultant turned nuclear critic named Kazuhiko Kobayashi. Kobayashi is fluent in German and just went on a speaking tour for the anti-nuclear activist group, the Association of Citizens Environmental Protection, or the OTP. He also wrote an impassioned letter for the Foundation of Ethics and Economics as they awarded the International Ethicon Black Planet Award for 2011. That Black Planet Award went to Tsunehisa Kutsumata, Masataka Shimizu, Toshio Nishizawa, and other responsible executives and major shareholders of Tokyo Electric Power Company, TEPCO. Find links to all that, including both video and audio in German of Kazuhiko Kobayashi speaking in many German cities. His talk was titled, "German Nuclear Phase-Out Has Given the World Hope." A German friend of Radio EcoShock writes, quote, "In a recent speech at protests against the Gronau uranium enrichment facility, Japanese Germanist Kazuhiko Kobayashi spoke about his country traditionally being run by a sort of unofficial troika of influential state officials, prominent politicians, and corporate managers. There is an organized fluctuation between the three groups to ensure connections whose particular interests have hampered the disaster relief efforts time and again." End quote. Keep in mind, Germany is attempting to lead the world out of nuclear power with some backsliding by politicians. Their struggle should be known by all the world, but that is another story. Right now, we will hear Kazuhiko speaking to German activists, translated into English by our friend of Radio EcoShock.
In our country, a case of high-ranking government officials is playing an enormous role. Wanted members went through certain universities and passed the exams, they are on a free ride to certain positions and departments. And once they are there, their power is so enormous that they can do virtually everything without any inspection. So our government officials can take it all. When they retire, they are being put on executive posts in big corporations. They enjoy their time as directors. And during those 5 to 10 years, they act as agents who put across corporate interests to the same government ministries where they have been working before. Now their successors are in their old positions and listen exactly what their former bosses are saying, because they know if they do what they are being told by the corporations, once they retire, they will get the same fantastic post. In their last decade, they can make just as much money as in their entire career. Nevertheless, this pays off for the corporations, because it allows them to control the government and gives them a free ride. So this relationship is mutual. Of course, the career politicians join in as well, since they are being bribed by the corporations, as in many other countries. But in our country, the influence of the government officials is enormous. Over 100 years, since the end of the samurai era, these three groups have been establishing this troika, time and again. Together they represent a political and economical power, for which they are ready to sacrifice everything, and to which the life of these people does not matter. This is the sad truth, and it became quite obvious in Fukushima.
That was Kazuhiko Kobayashi. Before we return to the fight to shut down unsafe nuclear power plants in the United States and lessons learned from Japanese activists, I want to investigate the stunning new study claiming 14,000 Americans have already died from radiation that floated over from the Fukushima nuclear accident in Japan. Two longtime American anti-nuclear activists with decades of experience in the field of radiation uncovered unsettling information, even in the sparse announcements published by the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency and the Center for Disease Control, the CDC. Joseph J. Mangano, the executive director of the Radiation and Public Health Project at radiation.org, co-founded, I might say, by Dr. Ernest Sternglass, Mangano has published scholarly articles and books like Low-Level Radiation and Immune System Disorders, An Atomic Era Legacy, and Radioactive Baby Teeth, The Cancer Link. On December 19th, Joseph Mangano, with co-author Jeanette Sherman, issued a press release about their newest medical article titled 14,000 U.S. Deaths Tied to Fukushima Reactor Disaster Fallout. This caused a storm of criticism and alarm. I heard about Jeanette Sherman a couple of years ago as a seasoned doctor and medical researcher. She was part of a study of thousands of baby teeth. The teeth showed higher levels of radioactive strontium-90 in children within 40 miles of any nuclear power plant. Sherman, as we will hear, was also the English editor of a large collection of papers about the health impacts of the Chernobyl nuclear power accident in the Ukraine. Let's talk with Jeanette Sherman.
Radio EcoShock.
A new study claims there were more American casualties from the Fukushima nuclear accident than all U.S. combat deaths in Iraq. Think about that. Joseph Mangano and Jeanette Sherman published their peer-reviewed study in the December 2011 edition of the International Journal of Health Services. I'm Alex Smith. We have toxicologist and internal medicine specialist Dr. Jeanette Sherman on the line with us now. Dr. Sherman, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you very much. You're in my favorite city.
Well, I'm pleased to talk with you. Now, just to orient listeners, I first heard about you years ago in the baby tooth study. Briefly, tell us, what was that about?
Well, we did a follow-up study with the Radiation and Public Health Group collecting baby teeth and testing them for strontium-90. This is an isotope that never appeared on Earth until the first atom bomb was blown off. And strontium-90 is produced when nuclear power plants function 24/7, and it is carried by the wind and rain and snow, deposited upon grasslands, and is taken up by dairy animals and concentrated in their milk. And when a woman is pregnant and drinks milk and dairy products, which she should, the strontium-90 becomes concentrated in the unborn's teeth and bones, and by collecting teeth that children normally shed when they're about 6 years old, we were able to measure the strontium-90 levels. And we found interesting things in that there was higher rates of various cancers in children born within 50 miles of not only cancer in children, but also in their parents, and in children born within 50 miles of a nuclear power plant. That's the short story. The original strontium-90 study was done in St. Louis in the 50s and resulted in stopping above-ground nuclear testing.
Very important. Well, now you and Dr. Mangano have published a new paper which will stretch the belief of many listeners. How could Americans have died from the nuclear power accident at faraway Fukushima Daiichi in Japan?
Well, we know, and you are in one of the key places in the world, that the reactors that melted down, they tried to contain them using water, millions of gallons of water, which then flowed out into the Pacific Ocean and also went up along the Aleutian Islands and down the coast of Western Canada and Western United States. Levels were detected within less than 2 weeks in the United States. Fallout, mostly cesium-137, but whenever you have cesium-137, you also have strontium-90, and they also found levels of iodine-131 across the United States. And we know that unless the Earth stops turning, that this kind of a fallout will ultimately contaminate the entire northern hemisphere. Obviously, greater fallout in Japan and close to Japan than further away, but we know from Chernobyl that it went around the entire northern hemisphere.
Please tell us how you came up with the estimate of 14,000 extra deaths after that wave of Fukushima radiation hit the United States in the spring of 2011.
I would ask that you interview Mr. Mangano, because he is the statistical guru of our group. But essentially, we looked at death rates before Fukushima and immediately after Fukushima for various years, and then we compared with death data produced by the U.S. government from the CDC, Center for Disease Control, plus EPA data, which unfortunately is limited, and it's just, it turns out statistically that through about seven cities, we were able to find higher rates of death from children, yes, less than 1 year of age, but also throughout the population.
But I thought radiation deaths only showed up decades later due to cancer. How could people die so quickly after that radioactive rain hit the U.S.?
Well, let's say that you are a cancer survivor, and you've had chemotherapy, and you've had radiation, and CT scans, and PET scans. It doesn't take much to push you over the edge because your immune system is compromised. And if you've already got illnesses, it doesn't take much that you can no longer cope with the stresses that you've been able to cope with. The issue with the children less than 1 year of age, which was also, by the way, found in British Columbia, is that the most vulnerable among us are the unborn or the newborns. Their immune systems are not fully formed, and the dosages per pound are much higher than they are for, say, a 150-pound person if you are a 4 or 5-pound baby.
Yes, the British Columbia Coroner's Service said that they found more sudden infant deaths in the first half of 2011 than in all of 2010. Did you find similar reports elsewhere?
Well, we've asked for data from Alaska, but they have not responded. I'd really like to know what's going on there.
Well, how much radiation did drop on the United States? Can you put any numbers to this?
I wish I could answer you that question, and it's an absolutely essential question. The U.S. Environmental Protection Agency was measuring the levels weekly here in the United States, and then in their own wisdom, they decided that quarterly would be enough. And I find it appalling because this is a unique opportunity in the history of the world to collect meaningful data, and the United States EPA is not doing it.
And another question comes to my mind. Were most of the deaths old people? We've talked about babies, but were there also a lot of old people who might have died anyway?
We elderly people are all, I mean, all of us are going to die. It's just that when you know what the average death statistics are, and it increased that period of time. I mean, we pretty well know what's going on, and this was a marked increase.
I hate to harp on this, but I know your critics will. I presume there are no death certificates saying that the cause of death was Fukushima radiation.
Oh, no, you're absolutely correct.
So isn't it possible something else caused this rise in mortality rates, like a strain of flu or something?
Well, it certainly could have. But, you know, if you're compromised, your immune system is compromised, your chances of not surviving flu are increased.
Were the methods you chose standard and acceptable to others who study disease and mortality statistics?
Oh, yes, because this paper was submitted for peer review. We have no idea who the peer reviewers were. I mean, that's done, for the people who write papers, that's done blindly. So we don't know who peer reviewed it, but they did pass the paper, and they did say it was acceptable for publication.
This is Radio EcoShock. We're talking with Dr. Jeanette Sherman. She's co-author of a new study showing perhaps 14,000 Americans may have died from radiation released at the Japanese nuclear power plant in Fukushima. Jeanette, most governments and media talk only about external radiation rather than the so-called hot particles that are taken inside the body. Can you talk about the difference and which types of radiation might have caused these extra deaths?
We're talking strictly about the isotopes that are taken into the body. And a normally functioning nuclear power plant releases about over 100 isotopes, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Now, Fukushima released many, many, many isotopes, but the ones that are mostly measured were the cesium, cesium-134, 137, the iodines, iodine-134. They did not do much in the way of measurements of strontium-90, but should be. And there were plutonium and many other isotopes that were released. As these are taken in by way of water and food, they concentrate in various parts of the body. Now, cesium is in the same family of chemicals as potassium. So cesium goes to all soft tissues in the body, including muscles and breast and pancreas and places like that. Strontium goes to the bones and teeth, and iodine goes to the thyroid gland. The unborn really have to have an adequate source of thyroid function, and if their thyroids are damaged, they don't do well. And I think we're seeing increased baby deaths because of this.
In addition to this fast rise in deaths, would you still expect an increase in cancer in North America in the coming decades due to the Fukushima accident?
Oh, definitely. I mean, I'm the editor of the Chernobyl book that was published by the New York Academy of Sciences. It's called Chernobyl: Consequences of the Catastrophe for Human and the Environment, Humans and the Environment. What happened after Chernobyl was there was a marked increase in thyroid disease and thyroid cancer, as well as in leukemia. Now, we did not publish this paper to scare people half to death or anything like that, but public health of people need to be prepared because we're going to be seeing these diseases in North America as a result of the fallout from Fukushima.
And you said it spread throughout the Northern Hemisphere, so I presume that governments in the UK and Europe, perhaps even Russia, should also be aware of this risk.
Yes, and I think they did get fairly good measurements in Europe, better than we got here in the United States.
You've talked about the public health angle, and I'm wondering, you know, I mean, the government and the media, they failed to warn us about these risks. Were there public health measures or personal steps we could have taken to reduce the casualties and the impact?
Well, if you're in the proximity of a nuclear release, particularly because of the iodine-131, one can take potassium iodide, but it has to be taken within the first 24 hours. So unless it's stockpiled in people's houses, then it's not going to work. And we have a law on the books here in the United States that potassium iodide is supposed to be available at all nuclear power plants. Well, I can't imagine people driving to some center to pick up potassium iodine tablets when, you know, if there's a nuclear release.
Well, what about just simple things like putting on a breathing mask to keep some of the particles out or staying out of the rain if it's raining, if you know there's been an accident? Would that help?
Well, I think it might help, but the biggest problem is the fallout on food. And we don't have a monitoring system, certainly not in this country, to determine what the food levels are. And my great concern is the marvelous fisheries along Alaska and British Columbia. And I don't know if anybody is doing measurements on fish to find out if they're contaminated or not, but the millions and millions of gallons of contaminated water is spreading, you know, throughout the Pacific.
Our Canadian government announced that they definitely would not be doing any testing. So, and then they sort of reversed themselves and said, well, maybe they would. So it's kind of up in the air. Well, look, I'm going to bet, Janet Sherman, that your study gets very little mainstream press. We won't see big headlines because this news is so horrible and unexpected. We have a gut reaction to protect ourselves by not believing it. Have you had criticism already?
Oh, of course. I mean, we've been, you know, called, you know, alarmists and cherry-picking our data, but this is pretty standard epidemiology, and unless the principles of biology and chemistry are rescinded, we are going to see this damage because these isotopes follow the normal isotopes throughout all living matter and result in harm. And we know, for instance, from Chernobyl, where they didn't test every living system, but wild animals, domestic animals, plants, birds, fish, bacteria, viruses, all were affected by the releases from Chernobyl. And we're going to see that, you know, around the world. Far worse, you know, the closer you are to Japan, but certainly throughout the Northern Hemisphere.
And Jeanette, what research needs to be done now, and you know, when it comes to the impact of Fukushima?
I think we need to have publicly available measurements in food and milk, dairy products, meat and fish, and available to people and easily available on the internet so people can find this information. I do know there's some volunteers who are collecting radiation levels, the information on radiation levels using GPS with Geiger counters in various places of Japan, which is absolutely brilliant because they can pinpoint what the levels are and where they are. We need to have monitoring in North America, in Canada and the United States, certainly.
Just as a public health protection, I would think we would have it, but apparently we don't, or we have it in a very haphazard way. As we wrap up, is there something else that you would like to talk to our listeners about?
I'd just say don't panic, but push your local government, and if necessary, then the various fisheries who are catching, you know, particularly with the wonderful salmon and the halibut, should do their own measurements and certify what their levels are.
Thank you. Our guest has been toxicologist and internist Jeanette Sherman. She is adjunct professor of Western Michigan University and a contributing editor of the book Chernobyl, Consequences of the Catastrophe for People and the Environment. Jeanette is also the author of the book Chemical Exposure and Disease and Life's Delicate Balance, The Causes and Prevention of Breast Cancer. Find out more at JeanetteSherman.com, and Jeanette has two T's in it. Find links to news articles, audio, and the published paper we're talking about in my blog at ecoshock.info. Jeanette, thank you so much for your years of work and for looking at what many of us don't want to see.
Well, thank you, I mean, for your service. This is very important, the work you're doing.
I'm Alex Smith, reporting for Radio EcoShock.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
Can this really be true? Did an extra 14,000 Americans die from Fukushima? The subtitle of the December 19th press release reads, "Impact seen as roughly comparable to radiation-related deaths after Chernobyl. Infants are hardest hit, with continuing research showing even higher possible death counts." This takes us into one of the most controversial areas of nuclear affairs. What is the safe level of radiation? Study after study admit there is no safe level of radiation. Reading further from the RPHP press release, quote, "Just 6 days after the disastrous meltdown struck four reactors at Fukushima on March 11th, scientists detected the plume of toxic fallout had arrived over American shores. Subsequent measurements by the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, the EPA, found levels of radiation in air, water, and milk hundreds of times above normal across the U.S. The highest detected levels of iodine-131 in precipitation in the U.S. were as follows, and normal is about 2 picocuries of iodine-131 per liter of water. 2 picocuries per 131 per liter of water. Boise, Idaho, 390. Kansas City, 200. Salt Lake City, 190. Jacksonville, Florida, 150. Olympia, Washington, 125. And Boston, Massachusetts, 92. End quote. So there is no doubt elevated levels of radiation was measured by the American government all across the country, but especially on the West Coast. Radio EcoShock ran an interview in the spring of 2011 with a Canadian scientist at Simon Fraser University who also measured elevated levels of radioactivity on Canada's West Coast. The RPHP press release says, quote, "The CDC issues weekly reports on numbers of deaths for 122 U.S. cities with a population over 100,000, or about 25-30% of the U.S. In the 14 weeks after Fukushima fallout arrived in the U.S., that's March 20th to June 25th, deaths reported to the CDC rose 4.46% from the same period in 2010, compared to just 2.34% in the 14 weeks prior. Estimated excess deaths during this period for the entire U.S. is about 14,000, end quote. The government reports an unusual rise in deaths without any explanation. We know radiation hit North America and can be harmful, especially to infants in the uterus and up to 1 year of age. Jeanette Shermett says adults with compromised immune systems, perhaps after cancer treatment, for example, are also vulnerable to more radiation like that generated by Fukushima. The Radiation and Public Health Project also posted a 42-minute audio press conference with journalists. I note that no major news sources attended, not Associated Press or Reuters. One journalist asked if there could be multiple causes beyond Fukushima for these excess deaths, and Joseph Mangano agreed there could be other causes as well. He called for more research to find out. Mangano answered another doubt with this explanation of three cases where low-level radiation impacts were denied, but then finally admitted by the government or the courts.
This is Joseph Mangano. I'll take that. Any statement such as the one you just mentioned, i.e. the levels of radiation exposure are too low to cause harm, are in conflict with the agreement of expert scientists. I'll refer you to a report, a Blue Ribbon panel called BEIR, B-E-I-R, 7, Biological Effects of Ionizing Radiation. They have produced seven reports over the years, and in their most recent one, 2005, they agreed that based on hundreds and hundreds of scientific articles, that even at low doses, there is risk to humans. And I'll follow that by giving three examples of historically where there were assumptions that low doses were not harmful to people, only to have that belief overturned. Number one is the practice of giving pregnant women abdominal x-rays, which doctors did not to harm people, but simply for diagnostic purposes to see, you know, how big the baby was and where the position was. The first article showing that this practice raised childhood cancer risk to the fetus took place in the late 1950s. It was met by a huge wave of opposition by obstetricians, by radiologists, by the nuclear industry. More articles came out about that, and finally, in the late 1970s, this practice was discontinued. The second example was the fallout from atomic bomb tests in Nevada in the 1950s and 60s. For years, government officials declared no harm until 1997, when the National Cancer Institute put out a report estimating that up to 212,000 Americans developed thyroid cancer alone from the iodine in bomb fallout. The third one is the case of workers in nuclear weapons plants, which, again, for years, the government measured their doses and declared that they were below, quote, safe permissible limits. Well, in the year 2000, the Energy Department put out a report stating that there was, based on dozens of articles, the workers were, in fact, susceptible to a variety of cancers, and now there is a program to compensate former workers with cancer. In summary, there's a basic dynamic here, which starts with an assumption of low doses being harmless, only to find out that after study, in fact, the opposite is true. So I think we must maintain an open mind here when studying Fukushima.
And here is a further key statement by Mangano in the press conference, namely that 14,000 people may have been killed due to Fukushima, but the researchers cannot actually prove that happened.
A correction. We haven't said that the Fukushima did, in fact, cause these excess, but may have caused. I want to make that quite clear. It's a clarion call for more extensive research.
Given that doubt, I find the headline for the study press release misleading. We don't know Fukushima caused 14,000 American deaths. But the thrust of the study seems valid, that it is possible, and the government has made no effort to find out why people died more after Fukushima. It seems biologically reasonable to me that many people in fragile states, whether infants or adults with medical problems, died following the blast of Fukushima, radiation hitting the North American coast and right over the whole continent, and Europe for that matter. When critics keep citing weak external radiation numbers, you know they are dodging the real risk of ingesting long-lived radioactive particles through food and water. I would also expect more cancers to develop in the population during the coming decades due to exposure to radioactive particles from the Fukushima nuclear accident. That is just common medical knowledge, as we learned from the Chernobyl accident as well. Be sure to find all our Fukushima links in this show blog at ecoshock.info. Find all our past programs as free MP3 downloads and subscribe to our free podcast at ecoshock.org. I'm your host, Alex Smith. Thank you so much for listening and for caring about your world.